session number 10589, reel 3.
Mr. Gillard, reel 3.
Well, it looked as if they could blow us out of the water at any moment. And our attacking force, our invading force, was the 1st Infantry Division. I trembled for them, I must say, and I trembled for myself as we moved in the early morning light onto this island of Pantelleria. And there was this great rock, this forbidding-looking feature sticking up out of the shining Mediterranean water. As we moved in, and all was silent, and at any moment one expected their guns to lash out at us. We did know, though, that they had a very heavy air bombardment in the night before we'd got sight of them. And we wondered what the effect of that would be, suspecting that if you have a volcano to defend, you'll have excavated it sufficiently to get in well inside it and to be secure from any kind of bombardment. However, we moved further and further and further forward, everybody on tiptoes of anxiety, and not a gun was fired. I think a few rifle shots when our first troops began to go ashore, if I remember rightly, but all the heart was out of the Italian defenders. We got there and we found that the island was exactly as we'd expected, that they had the most marvellous defensive positions, but they'd been frightened out of their lives by the bombardment they'd had, and there were 15,000 Italian troops on the island. They all surrendered. They were under the command of an admiral. He was required to attend to the Allied general, our general, to sign the instrument of surrender, which we brought with us. The signing was to take place on a landing strip. You see, the Pantelleria had been an objective we had to capture because it was an air base from which the Italians and the Germans operated fighter activities which were very destructive in the Mediterranean area. And they had actually excavated deep into the volcano, really deep in, like going deep into a mine. They'd excavated and they had their fighter hangars, their locations for their fighters, right deep under impregnable cover. But there was had to be, of course, an open landing strip on one of the terraces of the volcano, which they'd constructed. They'd constructed a take-off and landing strip there, a few hundred feet above the water, above the sea, and a great engineering operation which they'd carried out during the previous year or two. And this was where the signing was to take place. Now, the bombardment that I spoke of that had taken place before we got there had been carried out by aircraft drawn from many airfields in North Africa. And one of the bombarding forces was a New Zealand bomber unit, which was coming from, I forget just where, somewhere around, not far from Algiers, if I remember rightly. No, not Algiers, wait a minute, from Sousse. That's right. And they hadn't been properly briefed about the nature of the operation. They knew they were to bomb Pantelleria, but they'd not been told there was an invading force to follow in immediately. So they thought it'd be fun if their bombs were delayed action bombs, and that this would keep they'd drop the bombs and then they'd go off some hours later at irregular intervals and scare the daylights out of the Italians, who would never know where the next bomb was going to come from. So there was Pantelleria riddled with these delayed action bombs, which kept going off. But the one I remember most was at the moment of the signing of the ceremony, because the old Italian admiral was stuck on sitting on a chair at a rickety old desk which had been dragged out onto this landing strip. And before signing the document, he, in quavering Italian, asked to be informed whether he could assume that if he put his signature to this document, that all hostilities would cease forthwith. And he was given that assurance that all hostilities would cease forthwith if he put his name to it. So he put his name to it, and within 30 seconds there was the most tremendous detonation, because there was a delayed action bomb almost under his feet, which went off, scared the life out of all of us, I may say. But I think he didn't quite trust Allied assurances for some time after that. However, that was Pantelleria, and it fell into our hands. Then Sicily, which was, an operation that lasted about nearly 40 days, and a very hard fight, a big island, well garrisoned by the Germans. Monty found that Of course, he was conducting a very different kind of warfare here. This was not the kind of open terrain where he could deploy his tanks as he'd done in the desert. This was far from being that. I mean, the game was semi-volcanic, very much a ridged kind of surface to the ground of hard rock, which frustrate tanks. They couldn't disperse, they couldn't manoeuvre. And the Germans were very determined here. We took a lot of Italian prisoners, but the hard core of Germans remained. And we had some very, very tough battles in Sicily. And all of it under immense German air activity, because they were still, of course, supplied with plenty of air bases in Italy, which was not very far away. And they could, at night, I mean, nights in Sicily were absolute hell all the time we were there, because we were under continuous bombardment. However, in the end, we succeeded. We were joined, of course, by the American army under General Patton, so that Monty had his command and Patton had his command. And there was great rivalry between these two generals. And Patton, by various manoeuvres, managed to outwit Monty more than once, to Monty's great annoyance. However, the island...
Did Montgomery express that annoyance to you?
Oh, very much so, yes. Oh, yes, he was very frustrated. I mean, he wanted to capture Messina and get across the straits there. He wanted to be the first into Messina. But his route of advance took him over the mountains and was very difficult. Patton went right round the island, if you remember. He went up to Palermo, which had absolutely no military significance whatsoever. And then he turned east along the north coast of Sicily, and by various dodges, including lots of seaborne operations in which he hedgehogged, he leapfrogged, as it were, over the German forces in front of him and got behind them, he managed to get to Messina first, which is what he wanted to do, so he could represent himself as the victor of Sicily. Though he couldn't have done it, of course, without the tremendous effort put in by Monty and the Eighth Army.
What did Montgomery say to you about Patton then?
Oh, I cannot remember his exact words, but he was pretty frustrated at the fact that Patton appeared to be making all the running all the time, because he was covering large areas of country. His advances were great. But because there was nothing much in front of him, you see, all the Germans were confronting Montgomery, because that was the real danger to them. I don't remember the exact words that Monty said, but he indicated his displeasure.
He was open about it.
Oh, well, enough to me, yes. Not for quotation, I may say. No censor would ever have passed it. However, there it was. This campaign was fought in July and August, and we suffered more casualties through malaria and heat stroke. Sandfly fever and such troubles, more casualties that way, many more than we did through actual battle casualties, though the battle casualties themselves were serious. I myself got both malaria and sandfly fever, and they were both recurrent diseases. I mean, it took me many years to throw them off, because they keep coming back at you when you least expect it. And that must have happened to thousands and thousands of our troops. But however, right, we finished Sicily. And at the end of the Battle of Sicily, it was quite clear that very quickly we would be crossing the Straits of Messina and landing in the toe of Italy. That was the obvious next move. And Monty invited me to go with him in his own... He was going to cross the Straits of Messina in a duck, D.W.
D-U-K-W,
that's right, yes. And he invited me to go with him, and of course I was delighted at this. I mean, the thought of returning to Europe with the victorious army commander would make a tremendous story. And I was extremely frustrated to receive a signal from the army public relations people back in Algiers instructing me to return to Algiers, and it wasn't much a case of returning, I'd not been there before, but to make my way to Algiers before the operation began. And I took it to Monty and said, what's all this about? Why do I have to go back to Algiers? And he sort of nodded his head and said, Frank, I'm very sorry, I wanted you to be here, but I think you'd better do it. I think you'd better go back. So... okay, so you had to bum your way, you had to bum a lift, you know, you had to make your own arrangements for getting there. And I remember climbing on board an extremely overloaded Dakota, a DC-3 American aircraft, with innumerable other people who were going back to Algiers for other reasons, and loads of equipment and luggage. I thought the thing would never get off the landing strip, and I believe lots of other people thought so too. But eventually it dragged its landing gear up, and we got up and took off across the Mediterranean and got back to Algiers. And there I found that, in fact, in addition to Monty's landing in the heel, in the toe of Italy, there was to be another Allied landing, and this was to be an Anglo-American force called the Fifth Army, the army commanded by General Mark Clark, the American general, but including the British X Corps, which was to have been under the command of Horrocks, but Horrocks had been knocked out in an air raid on Bizerta, and so it was now commanded by General McCreary, British X Corps. And I was to go with them, and I was allocated a seat. And the landing was to take place at Salerno, just south of Naples. Now, this was a hastily assembled operation, not a very good one, in my opinion. Nevertheless, we set sail from where? From Tunis. Yes. A very large convoy, and it was going to take us. We were in ordinary troop landing craft and tank landing craft vessels, and it was going to be a six-day journey across the Mediterranean. And you'll know that these landing craft were designed primarily for crossing the English Channel out of 25 miles, not for crossing hundreds of miles of Mediterranean water. And as luck would have it, of course, we ran into a Mediterranean summer gale, which was absolutely horrid in these boats, because they're great flat-bottomed things. They came roaring up out of the water like a great seesaw as the waves came under them, and then they'd flop down with an enormous crash on the other side, and everybody would be shaken from head to foot, and all the equipment would be rattling about the place. It was a pretty lousy experience, really. And the German fighter aircraft found the convoy, not very difficult for them, because, after all, we were a very substantial convoy. And they bombed us repeatedly, and sank quite a few of our ships. And I got a very frightening experience on the landing craft where I was, where we all did, because the nearest of near misses sent up a great fountain of water just in our rear and disabled our steering. And we were virtually at a standstill in the water while the convoy was sweeping on, because the rule was that whatever happened, the convoy went on. If you were disabled, you stayed there and you took your fate, whatever it was. And so there we were, disabled, lying in the water, flying all the distress signals that they could possibly lay their hands on, while the convoy went on and on and on and on, and you could see yourself being left there, one solitary little landing craft with only a Bofors gun to defend yourself with, and the German fighters just turning on you with delight and dropping a few bombs which would send you to the bottom. And I really thought we'd had it. And then by some luck or other, good management down below in the engine room, they got the steering going again, and they got the damage somehow temporarily repaired, and we picked up and got some speed up, and we never got back to our place in the convoy, but we caught up with the tail of the convoy and went on. But this gale delayed us in the crossing of the Mediterranean quite severely. Now, plans had been made for us to spend on the last day of our journey to have to put in at Palermo and to have a great party there. And the troops already in occupation of Palermo had arranged all this, and it was going to be absolutely wonderful because we were going to be regaled with food and drink and all the fruit and so forth that was of the season in Sicily and in the Mediterranean areas. You know, we were going to have grapes and melons and all the lovely things you can think of, so different to ordinary hard tack that you had to put up with day after day in army life. And unfortunately, we were delayed, and when we got to Palermo, there was only time for us to lie off the coast, off the shore. We could never get the troops ashore, but we were told that if any of us could slip a dinghy down and go ashore with it, we could come back with it loaded with as many goodies as we could carry. So I went out with one of our dinghies and got ashore there. and got on to a very strange story, which was that for the last 3 or 4 days, a black three-engined aircraft coming from the Italian mainland had been seen landing in Sicily at the army headquarters and then taking off again some hours later and returning whence it came. And this seemed a pretty odd business. This was an enemy aircraft that was allowed through, obviously carrying VIPs, and which was going to and fro, and the only conclusion one could come to was that some negotiations for surrender were taking place. But nobody could guarantee that, and in the short time there was to be had there, it couldn't be investigated. But off we went for our last 24 hours of crossing of the Mediterranean from Palermo across to Salerno. And again, under air attack, but a few hours in the late afternoon of the day before the eve of our landings at Salerno, we were due to land on the Salerno beaches at dawn, we got from our own radio Eisenhower's announcement from Algiers over the radio that the Italians had surrendered and that Mussolini had been taken prisoner and that the Badoglio had... I think Mussolini was already dead, I'm wrong about that. That Badoglio had taken command of the Italian forces, that's right, the Italian General Badoglio. We got that in our landing craft. Our landing craft was by then again leading our part of the convoy, and we had with us the brigadier in charge of our section of the landing, and he insisted on turning about our landing craft and sailing down the lines of the convoy with a loud hailer in his hand, reporting to every landing craft as we passed us this tremendous news that the Italians had surrendered. A great cheer going up from every landing craft as we passed it and delivered this bit of information. And we were all elated because we imagined that with the Germans, with the Italians out of the war, the Germans wouldn't have time to carry out any great reoccupation or occupation of the defensive system and that we'd have a fairly easy landing at Salerno. My goodness, we couldn't have been more wrong. It was the toughest assault landing of the war, as far as I was concerned. More frightening in many ways than Dieppe, even. I count myself extremely lucky to be still alive, because I never came closer to death than in the landing at Salerno. The actual landing itself, under the most intense fire on the beaches. I mean, when everybody around you is picked off, and you are the one chap who manages to escape... And you're not even a combatant. All I had with me was a typewriter. It was incredible. But that happened. It really did. And, of course, our occupation of the beaches of Salerno was extremely hazardous for a very long time. The situation at Salerno was that the whole area of the Salerno Bay is ringed in by mountains. The Germans were in defensive positions in those mountains with full observation on us. You couldn't move anywhere. You couldn't move anywhere down there without being tracked by German gunfire. They had you under observation the whole time. In the few little places where it was possible to put up screens or to find a row of shrubs and bushes that would provide some feeble sort of screening, we did manage to create a landing strip for fighters, especially disabled fighters, that had come up from Malta or other bases and needed to land fairly quickly. We got a landing strip going there. But otherwise, it was very... And at night, the Germans used to break through our lines and come right down onto the beaches. And they were wearing our uniforms. I remember one night when an RAF padre appeared in the middle of our little camp and said, down to the beaches, the order is everybody to evacuate. And we really believed that evacuation was likely to take place because the bay seemed to be full of shipping ready to take us off. And there he was, this guy, to all intents and purposes, an RAF padre. There was great panic, everybody rushing round to get formed up, to get down to the beaches. And then somebody said, hey, who was that guy? Where is he? He was gone. And he was an infiltrator. He was a German. That sort of thing. It was as hazardous as that. I was in a very awkward set of circumstances here, because I had no means whatever of communicating with the BBC. I did bring ashore with me a little portable recorder thing. These were the days before tape recording, but I'd got a thing called a wire recorder, and I was trying to operate that, and trying to get my recordings back somehow to Malta, which was the best bet, for them to be transmitted through to London. And I was writing dispatches, hour after hour after hour, banging them out on my typewriter, half a dozen copies, as many copies as I could make, and handing out one copy, I rushed down to this little landing strip and hand a copy to any pilot who was about to take off to try to get back to Malta. I was handing them out to shipping all along the waterfront. Anything that was going back or likely to go back or likely to be in contact with somebody going back to Malta, and pleading with them to get this stuff back to the BBC, but it wasn't getting through. And on about the third or fourth day, when things were really very sticky indeed, the Germans had succeeded in driving a wedge between us for a time, and we'd had to fight very much to restore our position. I ran into Mark Clark, the general, and I said, "Well, tell me candidly, how do you think it's going?" And he said, "The only time I get really depressed is when I listen to the BBC. And the BBC, if you please," he says, "is quoting the German propaganda, and is even quoting the German communique, which says that that they are about to restore the situation at Salerno, and they're going to push us back into the sea." And he said, "I'm deeply concerned about this, because you think of the morale effect on my troops in forward positions. I've got men out here holding very precarious positions right out in the forward area. And there they are, and on their radios they hear that any moment we're about to pull our forces out, and they're asking themselves, what's going to happen to me?" And I said to Mark Clark, "Well, don't blame me." And he said, "But you're the BBC man on the spot." I said, "I know I am, but I have no means whatever of communicating with the BBC in London. And moreover, I have no means whatever of hearing what the BBC in London is saying. And if you want this situation to be rectified as far as BBC reporting is concerned, I shall have to get some help from you." And he said, "I would be prepared to give you 250 words a day on my direct communication set back to the War Office in London. Can you use that?" And I said, "Sure." So I began, he said, "I expect when it gets back to London, somebody will want to say that ought to be shared. The BBC won't have it exclusively." And I said, "Well, that can be fought out in London. I don't mind what happens to it. But certainly I'll get give me 250 words. And he said, "The other thing I'll do for you is I'll see you get a radio set. Where are you bivouacked?" And I told him where my little camp was. And he said, I gave him a map reference, and he said, "I'll get a radio set to you." And he was as good as his word in both respects. He gave me these 250 words a day, which is all enough, quite enough. I mean, you can say a lot in 250 words if you're concise. And all I needed to say was, "Don't believe the German communiques. You know, we're here, we're holding on. The shipping in the bay is reinforcement shipping. It's not come to take us off," which was true. It was the 7th Armored Division coming in. And that stuff began coming back over there then, very quickly. Wasn't in the voice. It had to be read by the announcer, but it was attributed to me, so it had that much authority. And it did a lot to restore confidence all over the place. And I was very grateful to Mark Clark. And the receiver I still have, it was a Hallicrafter receiver, which must have been taken out of one of his armoured vehicles, and which enabled me, it worked off an accumulator thing, and I could listen to London on it, and I was able to keep them constantly corrected. The battle for Salerno lasted about 3 weeks till we finally got into the town and subdued it, and then, of course, we advanced on Naples. And Naples was captured. And then we hoped, of course, to go quickly on from there to Rome, but there we were blocked all the way. We were now heading into winter. Naples fell on the 1st of October. This is 1943. And we were facing a bitterly cold winter in southern Italy. If anybody tells you that Italy is the place to go to for the winter, don't believe it. At least not that year. It was frightfully cold. But we kept up our pressure and lost a lot of lives. It was the whole business of the Monte Cassino attack. And there was this great commanding height of Monte Cassino, surmounted by an abbey, a great abbey church. I remember being invited by General Alexander, who was the Army Group Commander-in-Chief and who'd now established himself in the Royal Palace at Caserta, just north of Naples, magnificent place. And he'd invited me to lunch. And among other things, produced a bit of paper and said, "What do you make of this?" And it was a kind of memorandum. It was a copy of a memorandum from the Pope, addressed to the Allied commands, saying, and the German commands, saying, "The Abbey of Monte Cassino is Vatican property and therefore is neutral ground, and the respective combatants are therefore requested not to in any way to destroy it or damage it." And Alex said, what would you do about that if you received it?" I didn't know what to say. I mean, it's obviously a very tricky question. He said, "Do you believe the Germans are using it?" And I said, "Of course they're using it for observation purposes, but they'll go on using that mountain peak whether you destroy the abbey or whether you don't." And he said, "Yes, but what is the effect on the morale of my troops when they see that place up there, knowing that it's in German hands and is bound to be a focus of everybody's attention? When once you get into that part of the front, you can't fail to see the abbey. It's right up there on the hilltop, right in front of you." "That's what I've got to think about," he said. And of course, in the end, it was destroyed by our bombers. Destroyed by our bombers. I remember that day too, that morning, watching the air attack on Monte Cassino, and I was watching it from 2 or 3 miles back, well into our own territory, though we were quite close up to it. And I suddenly found standing beside me Oliver Lees, who was commanding the 8th Army then, Monty having been recalled to London. And Oliver said, "Well, what do you think of this bombing? Isn't it wonderfully accurate?" Now, I didn't think it was. I thought the bombing was all over the place. I mean, it seemed to me that bombs were falling. Yes, some of them were falling around the abbey, and no doubt the abbey was getting hit. But there were obviously a hell of a lot of bombs falling elsewhere, falling short and going beyond and all the rest of it. So I said, "Well, I think it's pretty mixed up lot of bombing. Some of it's on target, a lot of it isn't," and so forth. And a dispatch rider came tearing up to us, threw his motorbike down on the ground, dashed up, saluted Oliver Lees, and said, "General, I have to report to you your caravan has just been destroyed by a bomb." And that was miles behind us. Poor Oliver Lees was rather upset about that. However, the campaign continued, and the destruction of the abbey made no difference whatever in terms of the campaign, because the Germans were able to use the rubble of it even more effectively for defensive purposes than they could use the abbey itself. And weeks before the abbey was finally captured, I was recalled to the UK because the BBC was assembling its forces to prepare a proper reporting team for the landings in Normandy.
So you went there on the notorious occasion of Mark Clark's March on Rome?
No, I was not. I was back here in England by then, and had been back a couple of months. You see, the BBC, in fact, had very few seasoned war reporters.